My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Good afternoon. Joining us on the line now is Rachel Lennon. She was the National Trust's first senior curator of national public programs and national specialist for inclusive histories. She also curated Prejudice and Pride, a multi-award-winning program of exhibitions, publications, and events exploring LGBTQ plus heritage in 2017. Having grown up understanding that marriage was only for a man and a woman, she married her wife Claire in 2017. 3 years after the legislation of same-sex marriage in the UK. Her book, Wedded Wife, is a social history of marriage. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Hi, great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. So I bet you had great fun putting this book together and researching into the history of marriage. I bet it was fascinating.
It was. It was a roller coaster, actually, because there's so much in this book that it's a celebration, and there's so many really fun, genuinely fun, funny moments and stories in there. But then there's also this really dark history and these kind of more troubling stories that sit underneath it. So researching it was a bit of a roller coaster, and pulling it together, it was trying to get that tone right was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you go right back to the ancient customs of the Stone Age. What did marriage mean then?
I go back even further, really, in that marriage has existed in almost every society known to recorded history. And it's so been so diverse that historians, anthropologists really struggle to define it. So we think of marriage, is it between two people? And then actually we have this huge history of polygamy that, defies that. Or is it a man and a woman? And actually there's a big history of same-sex marriage across every populated continent. So it's been many things. In the West, we've seen a real evolution of marriage from something that's about joining people together. A lot of the history of marriage is the history of in-laws. So in the Stone Age and for a long time, it was about bringing different groups together. So for survival or, to thrive, for a lot of people, it's been about joining families together, about making connections that are about more than the two people in the middle of it in the way that we think of often now.
Yeah, it's bizarre, isn't it, when the parents have so much influence in a marriage or who comes to the wedding, when it's all a show for the father to invite all his business associates and things like that, mm-hmm. as opposed to it being a celebration of love for the two people getting married and who they want to come to their wedding.
Yeah, marriage is, it's still a very different thing to very different people and different communities. And people still look for very different things from their wedding day than from the marriage itself. And wedding practices are something that has evolved so much. Just even I think within my lifetime, we've seen the emphasis really shift from the kind of the families to that couple at the center. Even in the last, I'd say sort of, we're thinking kind of 20 years around kind of social media and before that, although kind of to the 50s, the Hollywood era of romance and these big kind of romantic weddings. So, there's been a lot of change in that very recently.
And it's a very personal thing as well. People really feel passionate, or some people feel passionate about doing what they want to do with their wedding day, whether that's, just the two of you, or just the two of you and parents and a couple of friends, or, a massive wedding with hundreds of people and a lot of money spent. It's a real personal thing how people want to celebrate that day.
It is. It really is. And I think people Many people are feeling more empowered. And even just since COVID, I think even as recently as sort of 2020, our sort of expectations are shifting, or our feeling of empowerment to say, like, this is our day, you know, we can own it, has shifted. And I talk a lot in the book about the way in which gender defines so much about understandings of marriage. So what does it mean to be a bride? And how's that different from being a groom or a wife or a husband? And there's so many things that, you know, I'm planning my own wedding to my wife that I encountered, that we still came up against these sort of expectations of, oh, but there is no groom, or, you know, do you have a best man? You know, like, how does the wedding party work without kind of, you know, bridesmaids, mother of the bride, mother of the groom? Like, gender really shapes so much of the traditions and expectations that we inherit. And I think people are feeling more empowered to, you know, not necessarily mean that gender is the defining characteristic, or that, you know, the really defining feature in choosing who's going to participate in your day. And I even think, really, right from the start, when we think about proposals and, you know, how you start this journey of committing your life to someone else, and there's still this expectation that, you know, women will wait passively, and this enormous pressure on men to pop the question. And for me, in a same-sex relationship, you know, if we'd both followed that habit and that routine and passively waited, you know, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be married. I think it's really great to see people step outside of some of the expectations they inherit and really question some of the traditions. I think I say somewhere in the book that tradition can be the last defense of the indefensible. And I think once you start getting to the point where you think, I don't know why I'm doing this, I'm just doing it because it's traditional, you can really, it's good to really question some of those things.
Absolutely. Yeah, tradition does not necessarily mean it's right. You know, traditions change over the years. And also, people don't have to stick to tradition. People literally can do what they want, especially when it's their own wedding day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, so in the UK, we're celebrating 10 years of same-sex marriage this month. And I think this sort of inclusion of same-sex couples within marriage really helps with that kind of lifting of pressure on that expectation, and, you know, that it has to be done a certain way. And one of the things I wanted to do in Wedded Wife was help show that there's never just been one right way. I think so many of us grow up thinking, this is how it's always been done. You know, men have always gone down on one knee to propose. Actually, that tradition's really recent. And I try and sort of question and unpick some of the inheritance that's come down to us that says there is only one right way to do something, and to help empower people to kind of make their own choice and question really what has been done before and whether that is right or right for them.
Yeah. So one of the traditions which I guess people were asking you about as a same-sex couple, which I'm interested to ask you about, is the when the father of the bride would traditionally give the bride away, that whole process of the father walking the bride down the aisle and then giving her away, as it were, at the end. What happens with a same-sex couple, whether it's men or women, when you talk about that moment, or is it just discarded completely?
Well, I think it's not exactly discarded. It's more that it's easier, I think, for same-sex couples to kind of look across all the options and really find the thing that fits best for them, and to really find their own way. So for me and my wife, we talked about it quite a lot. We were already living together when we got married. We planned the wedding together. We were already so much of a team that we decided to walk in together. So, and, you know, we were in our 30s. It didn't really feel right to us to be given away. We didn't want that moment for us. But I know that other same-sex couples make very different choices. But for us, we wanted to go in together. And it was a really lovely moment, and, you know, feeling like we had brought each other to that moment. And so to come together and walk into the one that we'd created, and, you know, all the people who were most important to us in the world there in front of us was, you know, holding hands. It was incredible, really lovely moment. And we had our nieces and nephews come in with us. So instead of thinking about kind of that question around kind of bridesmaids and maid of honor and all that kind of thing, we had all our little nieces and nephews going, which just felt really joyful. And I think that worked for us. And I think that sort of thinking about what works for you is maybe easier when you don't have that expectation of, you know, a father who's been looking forward to give you away for a really long time and is expecting to do that. And it can be difficult, I think, for some couples and some families to deviate, because it can feel like, oh, maybe it's an insult, or maybe it's, you know, it's theirs to lose, and that kind of thing. But yeah, that's how we did it, and that worked for us.
Lovely. I can see that working really well. And what about again, these are all traditions on the man and woman getting married, but what about things like hen nights and stag nights and things like that? How does that work with a same-sex couple?
Yeah, again, people find their own ways. And one of the really joyful things about same-sex marriage and bringing queer communities into marriage is that we can really think about gender in a much more fluid way and really let go of some of the sort of, you know, hen nights must be all women. So, but for us, we did actually, me and my wife did slightly different things. So we did have a kind of hen night each, a thought get together. And mine actually was all women, because that was who I wanted to invite, and they were my people. My wife invited a mixed sex group of friends and celebrated the sort of build up to the wedding with them. And I've known other same sex couples who have come together and had a sort of hen night with their sort of shared female friends, and that's worked for them. So again, you kind of, we find our own way with it and sort of work out what's going to work best for us.
Yeah. And that makes so much sense, doesn't it? It really does. And even if you are, even if you do have a union of a man and woman, you don't have to do these traditions. You don't have to have a hen night if you don't want to. You don't have to have a stag night. You could just decide to make the choice to all go out together, or just invite a close group of friends, which may contain both sexes. You know, that's it kind of, these little things remind us that we don't have to stick to traditions all the time.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we have a sense maybe that, you know, some of these traditions are very shallow. The roots of them are very shallow. So hen nights, you know, that's not a tradition that goes back, you know, beyond the 20th century. That's not something that's always been done. And we can choose which bits to take forward, which bits sort of serve us best. One of the things that we sort of struggled with and talked about quite a lot in the run-up to our marriage was name changing. And it's one of the things that comes up a lot when I talk about wedded wife and I do kind of panels and, you know, take questions from people. It's something that comes up a lot as a sort of an inheritance, a sort of expectation that, you know, in the UK, most women do still, the vast, vast majority, nearly 90% of women do still give up their family name when they get married. And it's such a stark statistic for families today. But then when you are marrying and going to have children, and we knew we wanted to have children, that was really important, going to be a really important part of our marriage. You know, what do you do then? And so we had lots of conversations around things like that. So sometimes it can feel quite liberating and light to sort of shake off the tradition. And sometimes it's quite tricky as you're trying to sort of navigate new ways.
So it is a kind of more traditional thing for same-sex couples to take each other's surname, so it becomes a double barrel name, so you both keep your surname in a way.
Yeah, I think it's more that that there is less tradition and less expectation on the sort of same-sex couples, and you are sort of writing the rules from scratch. I was really aware there was very little template to follow, and, you know, as we were making these choices, we both chose to keep our names, but we have double barreled our children's names, sort of passing on the kind of challenge to them. Because it's a tricky choice. So sometimes I was conscious in that time of, you know, becoming engaged and wedding planning and sort of forging our marriage. And it becomes, when you're in it, it's really quite all consuming, isn't it? So it takes a lot of your time and energy. I was conscious of that kind of liberation of, you know, being at this forefront of same-sex marriage and not inheriting this sort of weight of expectation, but also the challenges of not being able to just do the default thing and, you know, to have to consciously make every choice. So, yeah.
I remember when I got married, we did a lot of research into the marriage vows and all that kind of stuff. And I remember thinking it was quite liberating to realise that you can say whatever you like. You know, I think we've all seen on film and TV shows and probably in real life weddings as well, that people can, you know, read their own vows or write their own vows, should I say. So that suddenly opens up a whole world of possibilities in all the different ways that you can do it. And when you go back and look at the traditional wedding vows, there are lots of words that have definitely become out of date. And I think a lot of people, you know, they don't use the word obey, for example, honor and obey. You know, a lot of people kind of go, well, hold on a second, do I really want to obey my partner? You know, we don't think of things like that. We don't talk of things like that. So people over the years have been changing wedding vows a lot, haven't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I talk about vows quite a bit in the book, and especially, as you say, the word obey, which is really so telling, and it reflects so much of the history of marriage in the West. The fact that women were, you know, expected to stand usually at the altar and promise to obey another person with no anticipation of it being reciprocated, and knowing that the law would largely hold them to it, to hold them to this vow to obey. I write about a 19th century woman called Lucy Stone in the book, who was quite an early suffragist, so campaigning for women's rights to vote. And she married a fellow suffragist in the second half of the 1800s. And she wrote a speech to do within her vows at the altar in her wedding that was, she said, I'm not going to change my name. And I think basically all the laws around marriage are ridiculous and I won't obey my husband. And did this kind of protest speech about what it meant to be a woman, what it meant to be a wife in the 19th century, this incredible sort of moment. So yes, you're following in the footsteps of good people who have kind of reshaped their vows and spoken their true voice in their weddings.
Brilliant. Well, if people want to read the book, it's available on our website, tre.radio. It's called Wedded Wife, A Social History of Marriage, and it's by Rachel Lennon, who we've been chatting with today. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together, because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.